What's up, everybody? We are back with another edition of the Ad Podcast, and super excited to bring you guys a really fun guest today from our sister nation to the north in Canada, up in Calgary. We've got Ted Fleming, who is the founder of Partake Brewery, which is the number one largest non-alcoholic brewery in Canada, and they're making quite a dent here in the U.S. market as well. Ted started the brand, I believe, about 7 years ago. Is that right, Ted?
Yep, that's right.
All right. So he's currently the founder and has a few other entrepreneurial things that he's involved in. But we're going to talk to him today about his journey and defining the non-alcoholic beer category. So, Ted, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, fantastic, Dylan. Thanks for having me on here.
Yeah, my pleasure. So, Ted, I always like to ask founders and entrepreneurs, you know, what was that hairy, audacious problem that they identified that was keeping them up enough at night to go out there and take the undertaking of starting a company to address that problem. But I've done a little bit of research on you, and my understanding is that you experienced kind of a lifestyle event that really caused you to make some changes to your diet and other areas in and around health. So I'd love if you would be willing to share a little bit about what that journey was, and how did that lead you into the non-alcoholic beer category, and what did you discover once you got there?
Sure. Yeah. So pretty big story arc for me, going back to, for me, I was in my mid-20s and, you know, pretty healthy, active lifestyle I was living at that time, sort of just starting my career. And, you know, I was hit with this diagnosis of Crohn's disease, and didn't really know what that meant at the time. And, you know, I like to make some self-deprecating humor saying I'm a bit of a slow learner, but, you know, over the next 5 years, kind of really started to realize what that meant, and got to the point in 2010 where I was having a few hospitalizations. I became a father for the first time. And, you know, there were a couple things that came together where I really had to take a different trajectory, for a lot of different reasons, my health and my family, first among those. And, yeah, that was the first time I started thinking about, hey, giving up alcohol needs to be part of that, that revamp of my lifestyle. And, I sort of started down that trajectory, and, you know, it was a very hard transition for me because there weren't really great options at the time. I'd kind of started to really enjoy and get into the craft beer scene. I was living in Toronto at that time. And, you know, there was a new brewery opening up every week, it seemed. And, you know, I was there, I was, you know, trying to get the latest brews from the latest breweries, like everyone else at that time. And, you know, when I gave up alcohol, it was like, wow, it's not a very inviting, inclusive, friendly place for people that don't drink. Right. Like, I'd go out, with a group of friends, they'd all order the latest craft beer. I'd ask the server, hey, what do you have in the way of non-alc? And, you know, if I was lucky, I might get offered a Shirley Temple. Most of the options were like soda, juice, water. You know, one particularly memorable occasion, the server said to me, well, why don't you be a man like your buddies and order a beer? So, you know, didn't go over well, that comment in the moment, but that was like one of those like seeds that was planted of like, okay, well, you know, why can't I have a great tasting craft beer with my friends, albeit non-alcoholic, and help me stay on the path that I wanted? So, you know, that's some of the personal struggle that I dealt with early on that kind of, you know, as you said, kept me up at night and was like that problem that really was gnawing at me of like, how do I solve this? How do I solve this problem for me? And then, you know, as I embarked on that journey, discovering how I solved a problem shared by many, many other people.
Yeah, no, I love it. And I've shared with you a little bit on our interaction. So I got sober 10 years ago. September will be my 10-year anniversary of being sober. I found a similar situation, you know, 10 years ago where you know, my big hanging point, I guess, where I kind of put it off, I suppose, is I was a traveling salesperson in and around the marketing world. And I thought, oh man, how can I ever do my job if I, you know, can't take clients out and drink and be part of? And, my kind of hopes and dream, my fallacy that I was holding on to was kind of shattered when I met a guy who was the former chief revenue officer of Facebook who had been sober for 20 years. And he kind of showed me, oh yeah, you can actually do this job without drinking and, you know, wining and dining and entertaining. So I finally kind of put that part of my life behind me. But I found a similar, you know, experience. You know, I still wanted to be able to go out with clients. I didn't want to make a fuss about the fact that I wasn't drinking. So there was a period in my life where I'd actually show up to the restaurant or the bar, you know, 15 minutes or half an hour ahead of time. And I would corner the waitress and say, hey, every time you come over to my table, I want you to bring me a non-alcoholic beer. And I'm just not going to, you know, care what brand it is or what it was. But, you know, indefinitely, it was a poor version with a green label made by one of the large beer conglomerates that was just pretty much god awful, almost undrinkable. And, but then over the years, started to see, you know, the craft, non-alcoholic brew scene really take off. And maybe surprising to me, but not surprising to you, Partake was one of the early, beer, one of the first, what I would consider craft non-alcoholic beers that I had ever had. And was starting to say, oh, wow, like there's some people out there that are figuring this out. Flash forward today, you go into a Total Wine now and there's maybe a full half aisle of not only non-alcoholic options across spirits, wine, and beer, but, you know, an astounding amount of choice now in the beer space. But what I've always been really impressed about Partake is how you guys have stayed lower cal than maybe even athletic, but still maintain really, really crisp, interesting flavor profiles that don't get so light as like a hop water that just, you know, I feel like is almost not worth drinking because it's just not at all similar to the beer drinking experience. So I know that was a bit of a mouthful, but how did you kind of go out to solve the craft brew taste and profile and kind of culture of like what beer drinkers like me were used to before they quit drinking, but also kind of stayed in that locale side of things as well?
Mm-hmm. Well, Dylan, first of all, congratulations on 10 years. That's a pretty amazing accomplishment.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Like the taste calorie value proposition that we offer is like that, you know, I think for many of our consumers, that's a huge value add. I think we do the best job in the entire category of offering that, you know, that beer occasion. It looks like a beer, tastes like a beer. And doing that across a variety of craft styles and doing it at like 10 to 30 calories a can, which, you know, our team jokes, like you can burn more than 10 calories just lifting a beer and drinking it. So, you know, some people have called us the celery of beer, not because of taste, but because of that calorie burning analogy. But yeah, just going to back to like, how did that originate? And, you know, I talk a lot about to my team and to others about, you know, there's some beauty in having constraints. I think there's even a book out called the Beauty of Constraints. And mm-hmm. For us at the time, no one had made a craft non-alcoholic beer before. As you alluded to, we were one of the first, if not the first, in the market with craft non-alcoholic beer. I launched the brand in 2017, and you know, it took a lot of iteration and a lot of, you know, just persistence. I think I probably poured 20 or 30 batches of product down the drain. Some were just absolutely, absolutely undrinkable. But I, you know, I had to drink them in the spirit of science and progress. But you know, eventually that persistence paid off. Got to a, you know, a prototype that was, you know, pretty good, I would say. And you know, also because what I was doing was so unique. We were able to get some R&D and some innovation funding to professionalize the brewing process. Again, really didn't have any money, hadn't raised any capital at that point. The project was just kind of on spec at that point, and we were able to get some professional help to kind of take the product from sort of a desktop level to a commercial level, and that really helped in our eventual commercialization of the product at a full-scale brewery. So, a longer process, but I think, you know, one of the keys to our success, and, you know, I think today, like, the product is much better than that first version. We're consistently iterating and improving the product. Like, the product will never be perfect, so there's always room for us to improve, and we learn something new every year that we we continue at this business. Yeah, I think it's that persistence, and the persistence comes from, you know, that personal story. And it's like, okay, it's personal to me. I've got a customer base that this is really important to too. So, you know, I think collectively, like, we're here for the right reasons, and we're here to, you know, to change the way people interact with non-alc and have a healthier relationship with alcohol in many ways as well.
I love it. So I want to take you back to some of the early days. So my understanding is you guys launched on Kickstarter. You had a successful fundraise. I know there's some people love Kickstarter. Some people don't like the idea of crowdfunding. Will you tell me a little bit why you chose to go down the kind of perks-based crowdfunding, you know, Indiegogo Kickstarter model versus an equity crowdfunding? Maybe equity crowdfunding wasn't even available at that point. But I know a lot of people use a successful Kickstarter campaign almost as a marketing campaign in itself. So just kind of curious on your approach to Kickstarter and how you were able to complete a successful Kickstarter raise.
Sure. Yeah, I think, you know, I'll go back a little bit because some of this context is important. So like before Partake, I actually started the first non-alcoholic bottle shop in North America, selling other brands of non-alcoholic beer, non-alcoholic wine, cider, spirits as well. So first mover in that space. But because I was in Canada, and you know, most of the alcohol companies that were making these non-alc versions of products, I was too small for them. They didn't want to work with me. I couldn't get the labels that I wanted to bring my business to the US. And I had some, you know, potential customers in the US that got so mad at me because I couldn't ship to them that I, you know, that was one of the reasons for developing my own brand was, okay, I need to have label control. I was shipping a lot of products that were in glass at the time, and e-commerce and glass don't really go together very well. So I made all of Partake into aluminum cans. But I had this really great audience from that early business. They were all very like passionate about non-alc. And so when I told them, and in fact, you know, some of the push towards craft was from that community when they said, "Hey, Ted, can you find us craft non-alc beer?" And I was going out to try and source it. Couldn't find any. Went to some local breweries in Toronto, like I said, where I was living, and said, "Hey, I've got this great community. I've got this channel. I'm doing this, you know, this many hundreds of thousands of dollars in sales. Will you help me make, they're asking for this type of product. Will you help me make it?" And I got laughed out of so many tap rooms that, you know, I basically had to, you know, I was like, okay, I'll do it myself. I'll figure out how to do it myself. And so that community really came to me in the Kickstarter campaign. And so we reached our funding goal within 3 hours of pressing the launch button. Wow. Because that community was really jacked up about the project. And, you know, I think probably the most impactful message I got from someone in my community was someone who wrote me and said, "Ted, I hate IPA. Our first product was an IPA." And he said, "However, I'm still going to buy 10 cases from you, and I'm going to give it to all my friends who like IPA, just because I know you'll eventually go on and make, you know, a lager or a dark beer, stuff that I like. And I really just support what you're doing." So, you know, I think that just meant the world to me, and was like one of those early points of validation of like, hey, I'm really doing something that's important to a lot of people. And, you know, if I do that, if you do that as a business owner and you're creating a solution for a lot of people to a problem that they have, you know, the financial side will work itself out.
Yeah. I love that. And I think it's a great kind of story to, you know, if you build a channel or so the community really was around, you had tapped into this audience of consumers that wanted to find and curate and get good non-alcoholic beverage, but just didn't have a lot of options. And then through running that channel, did you eventually sunset that channel or sell it, or what happened to that venture?
Yeah, that kind of got merged into Partake. Okay. I think I sold my products and other products for a while, but you know, there became a bit of a conflict in interest, and I couldn't really give those other brands my full attention. And so I basically sunset the site. There were definitely some consumers and some of my customers that were disappointed, those that, you know, bought non-alc wine and didn't drink non-alc beer. Happy to say that there have been quite a few companies that have started up with that same business model, both in the US and Canada. So I think they're, those consumers are much better served today than I was able to serve them. But, you know, that's part and parcel with the evolution of the brand side, which I'm part of too.
I love it. So going back again to an early experience that I think was pivotal probably for you, you got to go on the Canadian equivalent of Shark Tank, which they called Dragon's Den up in your neck of the woods. Can you tell me a little bit about that experience? You know, I know that there's a whole ecosystem now around, you know, figuring out how to get on Shark Tank, companies that invest in, you know, there's a whole, it's like American Idol, you know, it's a factory now.
Yeah.
But I imagine, you know, back in 2017, that was probably early days when it was probably a little bit more pure. But would love to hear kind of what that experience was like for you. And then I think if my memory serves me correctly, I think you had a guest slot in a recent episode where you got to kind of full circle come back onto the show. So can you tell me about the original experience and then talk about your visit back to the show recently as a successful brand that was on the show?
Yeah, you bet. So I pitched in 2017. I had only a prototype of the product, so I didn't have a commercially selling non-alk partake. Wow. At that point. Even the product I had for the pitch got bottled like 48 hours beforehand and we were running out of time, and it was just like, okay, what are we going to do if we don't have the beer? So just so much craziness went into that pitch. I had built this cargo bike actually as like a marketing tool, and it had like this draft handle on it. And I didn't have a van, so I actually rode it from my house to the studio at like 7 a.m. And it was like this torrential downpour, and the people driving along the side of the road are like, what is this guy doing riding this bike in this pouring rain? Anyways, I got there at 7 a.m, completely drenched, you know, beer is on the inside of the bike, and it was a little roughed up, but you know, got everything in order. And then I had to wait for like 8 hours before I actually went on and pitched. And that was the hardest part, just sitting there in the green room waiting. And, you know, you do your pitch over and over to rehearse it. And it's like by hour six, you're like, okay, I'm going to lose my voice if I keep, you know, practicing like this. So, you know, eventually my turn came, got in there. I think I pitched really well. I'll give credit to the editors. They did a good job editing it, albeit there are a lot of instances where the question that was asked by the dragons and the answer I gave were spliced together. They weren't actually the flow of things, which is kind of somewhat awkward for me to watch now. But
yeah, I was a reality TV post-production producer at one time in my life. I did that on a TV show called Oprah Winfrey's Big Give. And we had, I think, 100 hours of footage for every 1 hour that you ever saw on TV. And we had these interview packets where we could literally write a line. It was almost like AI. But then the software would go and find, you know, two interviews, and then you would splice it with B-roll in the middle. And that's what you call frankenbiting. It's basically you write your own line from a front and the back of two different interviews and then splice it with B-roll. So yeah, it's a little manipulative of a trick in the reality genre, but it gets the job done.
Yeah. So when I watched it live, I was like, oh, this is so weird for that reason. But you know, it was a good pitch. By and large, the dragons liked the product. However, you know, there was one, I'll call them character. One of the characters had this very, you know, party persona. And so he was like, okay, I'm out. It's totally off brand for me. You know, I think the others, like super early in the category hadn't been developed. You know, none of the big companies had really leaned into non-alc at that point. So, you know, there was a lot of skepticism about the potential there. But there was one dragon who did have a beer background. She owns a brewery. She owns a distillery. She owns a bunch of liquor retailers as well. And, you know, she was able to bring that experience in context and say, hey, look, like every big brewer in the world is trying to do this, what you're mm-hmm. doing, and you've done it. Like you've done a great version of an IPA as a non-alc. And none of these huge brewers in the world have done that. And
wow,
you should be proud of that. And that was kind of, you know, huge validation for me. You know, she and I struck a deal on the show there. And yeah, that was a great moment of validation for me. And just saying, hey, Ted, you're on the, not, you know, notwithstanding the community I had, but now I had a, you know, a very successful entrepreneur and professional in the beer space say, hey, your product is outstanding and something that, you know, I haven't seen before in the world. And I'm, you know, I'm in this world.
That's awesome. So tell me a little bit about the bump that creates. Obviously a lot of people go on, they sometimes get investment, they sometimes don't, but oftentimes it's a pretty powerful branded content opportunity that I'm sure you can use in your own marketing. I imagine the eyeballs on those shows are worth their weight in gold. I mean, CNBC is basically the Shark Tank channel or the Entrepreneurs channel here in America. What kind of a bump does that have? Like, what is it? What in obviously in the investment was probably pretty pivotal to that stage in your journey, but what else does it do for you?
Yeah, I think in hindsight, I may have pitched a little early. Like, I think there's, you know, as an entrepreneur with a sort of a novel idea, you feel like, hey, I just want to get my idea out there and get validation and get people aware of it. Cause I know there's more people out there that this product and this solution would resonate with. At the same time, you know, we didn't have a great distribution footprint. We used the fact that I was on Dragon's Den to, you know, facilitate more buyer conversations and get that distribution footprint. But I think in hindsight, if I had waited 1 year, I think I would have got more bang for my buck from that exposure. Now, as you alluded to, they just did a follow-up this year with, like, you know, I think the bump from that is far better because we're nationally listed across Canada in pretty much every channel. We have exposure in the US and a lot of great retailers. So the bump from the more recent episode was quite a bit more than the early one, but it was important validation to take to retailers to get that additional distribution.
Yeah, that's awesome. So I wanted to talk a little bit about how you guys are able to take advantage of kind of the tier one, tier two, tier three marketing structures that we're, you know, subject to when marketing alcohol here in America. You know, we can only ship direct to consumer to 46 states, and that's a pretty recent innovation with, you know, some people that have figured out how to kind of work that. It's basically a glorified order form that kind of distributes your orders to the right distributors to get your products to consumers. And then you've got to work through distributors, and then you've got to go open up retail accounts door by door on the restaurant and the convenience side and then the big box. So it's a very antiquated process to market here in the US. I'm not quite familiar with the intricacies of the Canadian market if you guys are under the same constructs. But the other thing that I find interesting is that non-alcoholic beer is even, you know, I guess it has 0.5% or whatever alcohol, but that it even gets included in the same category. So my question to you is, as a marketer, did you have to build awareness for the brand in order to penetrate retail and kind of that brick and mortar footprint, or were you guys able to go direct to consumer fairly quickly in your journey because of the non-alcoholic status?
Yeah, well, because of the online store I built as a predecessor to Partake, like, we were probably the first beer company in the world to start direct to consumer only. Wow. Like, we had no other retailers than when we started other than, you know, our own direct to consumer channel. So it started from that. Direct to consumer is still a material part of our business today. Yeah, we do have a few states that don't allow us to ship D2C into them, which, you know, to me is still a bit of a head scratcher. In Canada, we don't have that issue. We can ship across the country without issue. But, you know, it's a great way to, you know, start a brand, to be able to talk to those consumers firsthand, to get around some of the gatekeepers that exist within traditional retail and distribution. And, you know, you use that success to open the doors to those conversations and say, hey, look, I've got, you know, direct to consumer allows you all this great information. We can go to, you know, for us, we were able to go to retailers and say, hey, look, like, 40% of our e-commerce customers are in your, you know, geographic footprint. We're doing great there. Like, that was a great, a great analogy and a great business case to take to a buyer that had, you know, a lot of our customers in their footprint and say, hey, look, our demographic is this and age group is this, and they're interested in natural food and they're interested in health and wellness and all these things you can gather from an e-commerce website and having that direct contact with consumers. You can take that to a retailer and really align with, okay, this retailer and our consumer really match up well geography wise, demographic wise, and make a case. And we were able to do that. So that was a key element in our ability to grow. And then, you know, some retailers are, you know, they're leaders in terms of like they're able to take a bit more risk and work with smaller brands and more emerging brands, and other retailers tend to, you know, look at those retailers and say, okay, what's working there? We'll bring it in. And there's a bit of a cascade effect. So we've been able to work with, you know, various successes at different levels and build upon that.
That's awesome. So your roots as a 100% direct consumer brand really drove your retail strategy. You kind of waited for the right doors to open, and then you could use data to reinforce those conversations on how you would make those channel partnerships successful.
Absolutely.
Yeah, very cool. I wanted to talk about your influencer program. In full transparency, I haven't been able to do a lot of research into how you guys are marketing specifically. I spent most of my research time focused on you as an entrepreneur, but would love to kind of just hear generally how you guys think about influencer creator marketing. Is that something that's on your guys' radar, or how do you guys treat kind of working with influencers?
Yeah, I think we, you know, just based on our history, there's a lot of grassroots elements to that for us. We have a program which we call our Partaker program. So, you know, people come into that program. It's a platform. It's kind of like Facebook or a social media, like our own social media platform that people can participate in. We give away a lot of beer. We give away a lot of Partake swag. You know, we ask them to come out to events that we run. We give them insider access to new products we launch. And it's just a way to give back to that sort of super fan community that we have. You know, more broadly than that, yeah, we do work with select influencers that maybe have a specific type of push for us or an audience alignment for us. We haven't worked with any like A-list celebrities at this point, but you know, we definitely talk to some over time. So yeah, we're open to different types of partnerships, different types of influencer partnerships as well, but it really has to be a fit with the brand. And you know, we're moving in a direction with the rebrand that we've done in the last year, really taking a, you know, a look at ourselves and what we mean to our community and what we mean to the evolving non-alc drinker out there. And we really see ourselves as a brand for people who are making it happen, making the most of their lives with the you know, with the freedom that comes from drinking non-alc, whether it's full-time like you and I and all the benefits that come from that, or if it's just on occasion based. You know, we're seeing tons of consumers come to the brand because, hey, I'm not drinking on the weekend, or I'm not drinking on the weekday, or I'm drinking two non-alcs at the same time I'm drinking two alcoholic beers, and the next day I'm feeling great and good to go, and it can do all the things that I want to achieve and do in life and meet up with the people I want to meet up with and have that really deep and engaging life. And, you know, alcohol can play a part or it can play a lesser part, and we're just part of that equation.
Yeah, no, I really love that. And then you touched on the fact that you guys did a rebrand recently. I wanted to ask you about that because when you sent me the samples, that was the first time I saw the new can. Love the look. I mean, the classic look was, I think, a great look, but I love the kind of the clean, you know, solid colors mix that you guys have so far. So why did you decide to do the rebrand, and what has been the impact that's had on consumers?
Sure. Yeah. The original, it's funny, the original design was crowdsourced from maybe 100-150 people on Facebook. And, you know, it gave us almost 7 years of of service. And that, like, that's fantastic. Most brands do two or three rebrands before they get to year seven. So we got a lot of mileage out of that original brand. It's near and dear to my heart. I got a lot of old cans around the house for sure. But I think the rebrand was important as we sort of hit a different stage in our evolution in terms of just our market penetration. Also the emerging consumer, with that consumer I was talking about who's flexing flexing between non-ALK and ALK on a more regular basis. You know, I think it was just important to kind of update the brand, give it that clean, sleek look, a little bit of a retro vibe for it there. And then, you know, I think the clean look also accentuates that calorie message. And, you know, and you can see the calories sort of circled right at the center top of the can and on the pack size. So we wanted to do a better job of like highlighting that super low calorie message, while keeping our message hierarchy clean. And I think one thing we do a really good job of is, you know, people don't have to think too hard about what style we're bringing to the table. It's IPA, it's pale ale, it's peach goza, it's blonde. So I think that's another continue.
Yep. There you go. Sorry, it slowed down for a second there. No, that's great. And then, so I wanted to ask you, what goes into launching a new flavor profile or a new style of beer? How often do you guys do that, and what goes into something like that?
Sure. Yeah, like early on in our evolution, it was really taking cues from our craft brew cousins. So IPA was our first beer. That was, you know, twofold. It was IPA was 20% of craft beer sales, so it was probably the biggest style within craft. It was also a bit of a challenge. It's like, okay, if we can do a craft non-alk IPA that tastes good, then other styles should be easier, because probably IPA is the hardest to do. So, you know, I think that was how we started. Our pale ale was our second beer, which was, you know, a bit of a change from IPA, but not too far. That second product actually won us the World Beer Award for best non-alcoholic beer in the entire world, which was another one of those sort of awards that opened up a lot of retail eyes and retail doors eventually. But today it's a little different. We've got this like super vibrant online community, super passionate fan base for the product. And so now we kind of marry up the feedback and that partaker community I mentioned. We're marrying up the feedback from those groups that we're in direct contact with, and then sort of marrying that up with the inspiration we get from the craft beer side of things. So we're trying to listen to our consumers as well as take cues from the craft beer side as well. So it's a bit of a balancing act between those two data points.
That's cool. And then on the awards side, so tell me a little bit about that. Is it an awards for non-alk specifically, or is it put up against in larger beer awards with alk? Like what's the breakdown there?
Yeah, so we've entered, you know, various awards over the years, international, in North America. We've won awards all across the world. Usually there's a subsegment for non-alk beer within that. Some don't, which are those of the fun, you know, more fun ones to win sometimes. Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. But, you know, I think the thing for us is like, we've won over a dozen awards across the globe. And, you know, calories is never a consideration. It's always around taste and body and head and all these beer qualities, and calories is never one of them. And I say to my team all the time, it's like, just imagine if that was a consideration, right? Like where would we be there? And we win these awards nonetheless, just based on taste. So, you know, I think that's a huge win for us, and a huge win for our consumers.
Yeah. Super exciting. So I want to pivot into a little bit around your personal brand. So you've done a really good job of actually, you know, I read in a prior interview that, you know, you're not a founder that is wanting to be, you know, glued to social media and, you know, be too much out there as the face of the brand. But you have really decided to dive in and invest heavily on LinkedIn and building your personal brand there. You've amassed quite a following, but what I was more impressed is your engagement that you get across posts. And then specifically how you and I connected was I have a friend named Molly Fettick who launched a non-alcoholic wine brand called Buzzkill. So I've kind of followed her journey. And then I've just kind of gone down the rabbit hole of all these other non-alcoholic entrepreneurs because I'm a big connoisseur of the category. So I'm always trying new things. And I can't remember, I commented on somebody's thing and then you commented on mine. And as soon as I knew it, you were in my DMs offering to send me some samples. And I was super excited that I had already, you know, was a fan of the brand, but hey, I'll always take some free beer. So we had an interaction and I thought that was really cool because I haven't really seen any direct consumer brands do trial on LinkedIn. So just kind of curious of, you know, what's your approach to building your personal brand on LinkedIn? And then I'd love to know how you've been able to leverage it as a larger marketing strategy for the brand, tying your personal brand to the Partake brand.
Sure. Yeah. Like early on when, you know, the business was just me, I was managing all our social media, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn at that time. And, you know, as the business evolved, we were able to hire people to manage those things. And for me, you know, I felt like LinkedIn was the channel that I wanted to focus on. I couldn't manage them all. I didn't want to. I don't even, you know, I barely on a personal wanted to focus on one particular channel and one audience and have a voice there that I could, you know, I could interact with people and have the bandwidth to do without, you know, taking away with a lot of the other obligations you have as a CEO and a founder. So, you know, part of it was out of necessity of like, okay, I can only really devote myself to one and let's do one thing really well. And, you know, like we do just non-alc beer, we want to do, you know, be known for something. And, you know, for me, that was LinkedIn from a social media perspective. And I think that's important because it gives me the time to communicate back and forth with people. I got a ton of people that reach out to me for advice as an entrepreneur, as a founder. You know, I think Molly and I connected because, you know, she launched her brand on social and nice. I picked it up and was like, hey, you know, just, you know, please feel free to use me as a resource. Give me a call. We ended up doing that. And, you know, so I do that with a lot of entrepreneurs starting. I always have time for people who are starting on this journey, and it's a tough one and a lonely one. So, you know, it's important for us to support each other. And, you know, I do that through LinkedIn. And then, you know, it just evolved as a, you know, a social listening tool for me too. It's like anyone who's like, hey, I drink non-alc beer, I'm happy to reach out. It's like, hey, let's connect. This is my brand. I'm happy to, you know, if you haven't tried it before, happy to send you samples. It's, I think for a lot of people, it's a refreshing LinkedIn message. A lot of people are being tried to sell. And I'm like, hey, this is the opposite type of message that you're used to, right? I'm trying to give you something.
Yeah.
Right? No, it's pretty effective.
Yeah, it's genius. Definitely a big fan. So and excited that we were able to make a connection through that. And that was definitely a highlight to then be able to recruit you to come onto the show. So I appreciate that. I read in your bio that you're also an avid pickleball player. Obviously, that sport is taking off. We have a program down here at my local court called Dinks and Drinks. It's kind of happy hour meets pickleball. Any ambitions of getting into pickleball in a bigger way with the brand, with some of the pro leagues and stuff like that?
Yeah, we've actually done that. We announced partnership with the APP Tour for this year. So I think we've already done about a half dozen events with them. So, you know, whether it's Florida, it's in New York, it's in Cincinnati, like we're all over the U.S. doing tournaments with them and then working with their community. We actually built out a Partake community award. So we created an award in association with the APP that recognizes people that are really building the inclusivity of pickleball in their home community. And inclusivity is obviously a big component of why Partake exists today. And that, you know, going back to that story I shared with you at me at the bar and just wanting to be included in that beer occasion with my friends. And so, you know, we're really happy to sponsor people that are making sure that pickleball remains inclusive, because I think it's just a great sport for people to join from zero to being, you know, active members in the game. I think it's as good as any other sport for just being really accessible.
I love that. Well, we're getting down to the final stretch here. I don't want to take up too much of your time this evening. I know it's a little bit later on your end of the world. So what are you most excited about for, say, the next 6 months to 12 months for the work that you're doing at Partake? What's coming down the pipeline in the future that you can talk about that you're really excited to see roll out for the rest of the year?
Yeah, we've just been let know that we're going national with Whole Foods. So that's going to be a huge win for us. We've been working at that for several years. So that's probably the biggest new account for us, an extension of what we've been doing with them over the last couple of years. So I'm pretty excited about that in the next 6 months, and always working to partner with other retailers to bring our product to our fans and our consumers.
Yeah, very cool. Well, Ted, you're doing an excellent job. I appreciate you pioneering this space for sad beer drinkers like me that were stuck with O'Doul's for way too long. And now, you know, such a plethora of options. You know, I'm a big believer that, you know, if you as a founder can not just grow a brand, but you can grow a category, you know, you're really doing something right. So props to you for being an innovator and an early adopter for the trend, and really a pioneer for this space. And, you know, I think you hit the nail on the head too. Like, it's not just about people that don't drink alcohol anymore. It's about that flexible drinker, you know, that drinker that maybe, you know, does dry January, or like you said, doesn't drink Monday through Friday, but maybe lets themselves, you know, indulge a little bit on the weekend. I think this generation is the first generation that will probably end up drinking less alcohol than the last, and probably a good thing for society in general, but definitely with some of the health trends, you know, in the last, this generation will be the first generation that will have a shorter lifespan here in America than their prior generation or than their parents. So I think, you know, the work that you're doing is really exciting. And us as craft non-alcoholic beer drinkers, we thank you for it. So thanks for spending some time on the show with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Dylan. Lots of work to do ahead of us, but yeah, happy to be part of that that journey for a lot of people.
Yeah. Anything else you want to plug before I let you go?
Just that you can find us at drinkpartake.com and a whole bunch of other retailers across the U.S. and Canada.
All right. Awesome. Well, hey, for those of you who are watching at home, if you enjoyed the conversation that I had with Ted today, wherever you are watching or listening, don't forget to subscribe to the show. If you leave us a review, that's how the show organically finds a larger audience. So we always appreciate those of you that are willing to leave a great review. And most importantly, if there's somebody out there in your professional network, in the non-alcoholic space, in the beverage space, in the entrepreneurial space, and you feel like they would have a benefit from hearing the conversation that I had with Ted today, don't forget to share the show. So with that, we will let you go until next week. Ted, thanks so much for coming on the show, bud.
Awesome. Thanks, Dylan.